It's Ideasphere with Dr. Susanna Walters, The Tolerance Trap.
Most social movements that have really been robust, challenging movements have asked for what I would call a kind of robust integration rather than simply acceptance or tolerance. Right? I mean, the civil rights movement, you know, say, oh, just tolerate me, you know? We actually say, you know, you need to challenge white privilege.
In her book, The Tolerance Trap, How God, Genes, and Good Intentions Are Sabotaging Gay Equality, Dr. Susanna Walters explores how notions of tolerance limit the possibilities for real liberation and deep social belonging. Her book is centered on questions of gender, sexuality, family, and popular culture. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with Dr. Walters, Professor of Sociology and Director of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Program, City University of New York. Walter's previous book is All the Rage, The Story of Gay Visibility in America. Dr. Walters, thanks so much for taking this time.
Well, thank you.
You have a book that's going to raise some eyebrows. It's going to be a controversial piece, but I think as readers begin to understand the perspective you're taking with this, it's going to make a lot more sense. So I want to start with something you say that is going to start the eyebrows raising, and that is tolerance allows bigotry to stay in place and shores up irrational hatred. That's bold.
It is a bit bold, but, you know, I've taken a strong position here about tolerance. I think there are two general feelings people have about tolerance. I think the most dominant one is that tolerance is a great thing. Who doesn't like tolerance? You want to be thought of as a tolerant person. We want to be thought of as a more tolerant society. And I think when we get a little more critical, I think sometimes people will say, okay, tolerance, like acceptance, is limited. We want to talk more about embracing different groups and being more than tolerant. And maybe tolerance is just a step in the direction towards a more open-ended embrace of social difference. I actually make a different argument.
Yes.
Which is that tolerance actually undermines the potential for more liberatory visions of the social world. That tolerance stands in the way. That tolerance is a trap, because part of the reason tolerance is a trap is that it allows us as a nation to believe that we have won, to believe that bigotry is gone. So we say, okay, now in 17 states, gay people can get married. We have lots of anti-discrimination laws on the books in states all around the country. More and more gays are in open positions of leadership around the country, in politics, in popular culture, in Hollywood. And so we pat ourselves on the back and we say, boy, you know, we are a more tolerant society. Well, of course, there's some truth to that. I'd be the last person to say that there's not some truth to that. I think that the language of tolerance stops us from really investigating where bigotry still finds a welcome home and where bigotry still flourishes, not just trickles along there, but still is robust.
One of the things that you write about is that this work, and it's very true, is challenging the perceived wisdom, something that we feel is ingrained in ourselves, and that way we are bettering ourselves as we move along. And you've partly answered that, but I'd like you to go into more detail.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I think as a nation in particular, we tend to believe in stories of progress a lot, and we like to talk about post things a lot. So we get a black president elected, and there's all this talk about we're in a post-racial America. You know, we get some gains for women in terms of wage equity and in terms of changing some ideas about gender, and we say we're in a post-feminist era. And I think we see some of the same thing happening around gay rights now. We make some strides. We become a better world in some ways, and we immediately declare victory. We say, well, that's it. We can just pack up our bags and go home. We're in a post-gay America now. And in fact, that phrase is being used all over the place. It's post-homophobia. It's post-gay. Well, of course, the reality is much murkier and much more depressing. The continuation of anti-gay animus goes on unabated. Gays and lesbians are more disproportionately likely to be homeless, disproportionately likely gay youth to be suicidal or other forms of self-harm. Gay youth report bullying at epic numbers. We still haven't been able to pass an Employment Non-Discrimination Act. Gays are discriminated in the workplace, in hiring, when they go out and look for homes, and in rental, the rental market. So we see forms of discrimination, and more subtle forms as well, existing even in this time that we have declared an end to homophobia, an end to the need for a gay movement. Now, I think what that does then is it makes it hard to re-energize an anti-homophobic movement. If you say, we're in a new tolerant world, we're in a post-gay world, all of this work is done, victory is at hand, then in fact it makes it hard to do two things. It makes it hard to energize a movement, and it also makes it hard to critique where and when and in what ways anti-gay hatred still persists.
In fact, it's on a slight rise.
Yeah. The irony or not, I guess, of this particular moment is, you know, at the moment we declare the great victory over homophobia, anti-gay hatred and acts of anti-gay violence have been on a rise, absolutely.
It's very discouraging when we think that we have come so far, but as you show, just look at our political platforms between the Democrats and Republicans. They're so divided over the same issue.
I think you're absolutely right. They're so divided. I mean, there's no doubt that the Republicans and the Christian conservatives are still using gays as sort of the central target in the culture wars. There's no doubt about that. But I would even say on the other side of the aisle, where Democrats have assuredly embraced gay rights with more fervor than the Republicans have, it is almost wholly around the issue of gay marriage. And of course, that's another big aspect of this book, is critiquing our obsession with same-sex marriage as the sign of all things freedom-loving. You know, that in fact, when you look, for example, at the, and I watched these things assiduously, the last Democratic convention, which really was in many ways very moving and had all kinds of gay speakers making quite moving speeches. Almost all of those and almost all of the sort of homage to gay rights that took place in the Democratic Party in that convention was around gay marriage. So that, and it's the same thing, you know, in the media, and you Google gay rights and you will get gay marriage. It has come to a situation where gay marriage has come to stand in for all aspects, and there's a wide range of aspects of gay citizenship, gay rights, and gay equality.
In case you're just tuning in, talking with Dr. Susanna Walters, The Tolerance Trap, How God, Genes, and Good Intentions Are Sabotaging Gay Equality. This is now available in hardcover. Dr. Walters, do you have a website or blog you'd like to recommend?
I do have a website that is up on thetolerancetrap.com. And there is information about the book and a blog on that site as well.
Good. We'll have that information posted at Public Radio Exchange, where you can hear this program in its entirety in case you're tuning in late, or at National Public Radio's podcasts, npr.org, under Ideasphere. Dr. Susanna Walters, The Tolerance Trap. Should we talk about the closet? It's one of those things that we have enveloped into our vocabulary that is not quite up to date. Can I use that phrase?
Yes, absolutely. I spend a lot of time in the book talking about the whole phenomenon of the closet and coming out. And it's interesting to me because at the same moment that we also declare this is a post-gay world and, you know, the battle for gay rights has largely been won, we also declare, and there's been a lot of media coverage of this, that coming out is a big ho-hum, that's no longer an issue. Everyone can come out. No one cares anymore. The sort of closet doors have been flung wide open. Again, while there is some truth that certainly more and more people are out in all realms of our society, obviously, if the closet weren't still a pervasive force on people's lives, we would simply have more than one or two or three out gay politicians in national life. We would have more than one or two or three major out gay Hollywood stars. So that, in fact, it is again declaring victory before we've even gotten anywhere near to victory.
Well, it's just like most recently that young football player trying to make it into the ranks of the professional field, NFL, and another player not on the same team said, I do not want to share the field or the locker room with a homosexual.
Right. Absolutely. And that's exactly what we need to be able to keep that simultaneous phenomenon in our minds. That's what I think we're having trouble with. So here is this thing that happens where the first NFL player comes out while he's still playing. This is a big thing, right? And everyone's celebrating this and this major event. At the same time, there's a huge outpouring of support for him, but there also is all of this presence, as you say, of anti-gay animus that responds to his coming out. And again, the other point I would say is, what does it mean in 2014 that the coming out of a football player is still big news? That's where we have to sit back and say how far we haven't come. I mean, I guess I'm a little bit sometimes a glass half empty sort of person with this. Why? I mean, you know, I'm thrilled that we're making these strides. I also have to say, the first, we're still at the first in a lot of arenas of social life, certainly in professional sports.
And we're a long way from what you refer to as the rainbow nirvana.
Right. And again, I think the danger of this discourse of tolerance is that we take these things, you know, the football player, the celebrity coming out, gay marriage, you know, in 17 states now, we take these as sure and unassailable signs that the battle for gay rights has been won, that we are in that rainbow nirvana, that we're in a really new world. We're in a somewhat different world, but it is exceedingly dangerous to declare a sort of victory before we've even begun the fight. And it's, again, analogous to declaring, you know, a sort of post-racial world because we've elected an African-American president. Look, there are more and more people of color incarcerated than ever before. Income inequality is enormous racially. So the idea that electing a black president signals the end of racism is as ludicrous as the idea that a football player coming out and gay people being allowed basic civil rights around marriage equality is the same as the end of homophobia. It's just not the case.
Looking back on something you said earlier rings true at this point, and this you mentioned for a second time with gay marriage. Looking at the opposing platforms, Democratic and Republican parties, the red states and the blue states, evenly divided once again on this issue of equality, or I should say marriages.
Yes, I mean, there's no question that there's a divide on this in terms of Republicans and Democrats. There's a divide on that issue generationally, a huge divide generationally. And a lot of people believe in terms of marriage equality issues that, you know, this is really about an aging out of a population that will allow this to really come to fruition in all of the states. And one of the things you see, of course, is some of the backlash happening in recent move to sort of instantiate some anti-gay laws, the one that was voted down that was vetoed by the governor in Arizona. Bills like that, I think there were four of these bills recently around the country that were an attempt to really sort of backlash attempt to say, okay, gays have gone too far here. Let's make sure we put more strictures on equal access to services. And these laws were really sort of Jim Crow kinds of laws. So the fact that those kinds of laws can be debated as if they're legitimate in this moment is again more evidence that we are hardly in a post-gay moment. Now, let me be clear. I'm not wholly pessimistic here. I mean, I do think things have changed enormously. I am much happier to be in this world than the world I grew up in. It is a better place. I see more representations of gay life, of gay identity, more freedoms. You know, there is progress. But I think that progress can be undermined if we hinge it on notions of tolerance. No social movement worth its salt has asked for tolerance. We ask for freedom. We ask for rights. We ask for inclusion. To ask for tolerance is so weak and tepid a demand to make of the society in which you are a citizen.
And this is where you butt heads with the mainstream, in that you're saying being just like everyone else is not really the solid goal it sounds to be.
Absolutely. And being just like everyone else, I think, strips both sides of the potential to be gained from gay difference. So I think a tolerance and acceptance doesn't allow straights to really learn from all that the gay community has developed over these many, many years of formation. And it doesn't allow gays to really revel in their own difference and differences that come about through historical forms of community and of oppression and of struggle. And, you know, again, most social movements that have really been robust, challenging movements have asked for what I would call a kind of robust integration rather than simply acceptance or tolerance. Right? I mean, the civil rights movement, you know, they say, oh, just tolerate me, you know. We actually say, you know, you need to challenge white privilege. The women's movement didn't say, oh, you know, just tolerate us here. But actually, we need to think about gender and how gender structures the ways in which we approach everything, and how gender inequity is damaging to all of us, and how gender stereotypes damage all of us. And I think we need to do similar things around gay rights. But we've come stuck in this tolerance trap that just undermines that possibility and that vision.
And that actually causes problems with the issue of the gay gene, because it does inherit some very serious issues.
Oh, that's for sure. Yeah, I mean, the arguments about born this way and immutability and, are really problematic and spread throughout our culture. And they are used in every possible way and have become so dominant, I think. Most people really believe, I do think this is the case right now, that most people, good people, people of good faith who really want to support gay rights, believe that to support gay rights, what you need to believe is that gays can't help themselves, that gays are just born that way. It's immutable. It's some genetic thing. It's something in the endocrine system. You know, it's like hair color. It just is, and they can't help themselves, and they should get their rights because they can't help themselves. And that's a pretty thin argument to base social justice on. You should get rights because you're a citizen and a human being. The question of origin should have nothing to do with it. And of course, historically, the ways in which biological arguments have been used to undermine access to rights, certainly for women, for people of color, the history of the Holocaust is, of course, a history of that. The use of biological arguments to argue that people are inferior and are therefore not worthy of rights. You can't hinge social rights and inclusion on biological arguments. It just won't do. I mean, the science is bad anyway. That's a whole other subject. But it's just a thin argument, and I think one we really need to resist. And it worries me very much because it really has become our national narrative. I can't tell you how many times I speak on gay rights and I get to this particular subject about the sort of criticizing the idea of being born that way, and people look at me absolutely wide-eyed. How is it possible you don't believe that gays are born that way? And my answer is, I don't care. I don't care how straights are born that way. I don't care if gays are born. I don't care if bisexuals are born that way. I don't care if born that way. I care that we're here. And we are people, and we are human beings, and we are citizens, and deserving of rights and inclusion and integration.
Dr. Susanna Walters, The Tolerance Trap: How God, Genes, and Good Intentions Are Sabotaging Gay Equality. Check out her website at thetolerancetrap.com. You're listening to Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rothbun. We'll be right back.
And you're listening to KCBX. Coming up in just about 10 minutes at 2 o'clock, it's The Splendid Table. The author of Vegetable Literacy, Deborah Madison, offers the missing puzzle piece for vegetable cooking, the plants. Also, hear a discussion with the duo from The Perennial Plate, an online documentary series dedicated to socially responsible and adventurous eating. That's The Splendid Table, coming up at 2 o'clock here on Public Radio KCBX.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with Dr. Susanna Walters, The Tolerance Trap. Virtual identity, virtually out. I didn't really put a lot of thought into this until I saw your material.
Well, it's an interesting situation about how we think about gay identity and sexuality in an era of the internet. And I particularly talk about that in terms of coming out stories and how people access the internet in coming out stories, folks who are often very isolated in all kinds of ways, geographically isolated, emotionally isolated. And so there's a way in which when we talk about the sort of contemporary state of gay rights and the gay movement, we certainly need to think about the ways in which the incredible transformation that the internet has wrought on all of our lives plays into that. And I think there's certainly, for many folks, the internet has become the space of the creation of gay community. Some of the downside of that, of course, is the shift away from real geographical communities where people can build social movements. And so I think that's some of the flip side of the virtual space of the internet sometimes allows us, I think, to not spend time in those embodied spaces as much anymore.
You have one person writing that the internet is the thing that has kept me sane.
Yes.
I live constantly in fear.
Yes, the internet transformed in this phenomenon of coming out. I mean, if for earlier generations, coming out was always an embodied phenomenon. I mean, you had to sit your parents down in the living room and look them in the eye and say something to them. Or you talk to your friends in the college dorm or a friend in a bar. Or coming out was very much about entry into a physical place with all of the fear that that brings, the physical fear, the fear of people's response. One of the things that happens in an internet world and in a virtual world is that you can come out and experience a sense of coming into identity and community without some of that fear. And that's a wonderful thing. Now, I don't think fear has disappeared, of course, because one always does still walk in a real world. One doesn't just live in these virtual worlds. But one of the things we have found is that the experience of being able to access those communities on the internet and come out with others on the internet has given, particularly for young people and particularly for people who are in maybe isolated or more rural communities, has allowed people to find some sense of safety in an environment in which they really might not be able to do anything but live in a kind of closet.
Would you like to take a minute and explain what constitutes full citizenship for lesbians and gays?
Oh, boy, that's a big question.
I know it. I know that. You only took about 40 pages. Narrow that down.
I'll see what I can do. I think one thing I can say, I hope it's not too much of a cop-out, is that we can't know in advance what real citizenship looks like because we don't have it. Certainly, basic social rights, whether it's marriage, military rights, rights for equal employment, the right not to be battered and not to be harassed and not to be gay bashed and not to be a source of mockery, those are necessary but not sufficient conditions for citizenship. But when I think about real citizenship, I think about notions of belonging and feeling that you are fully invested and engaged in that which you are a part of, whether it's a community, whether it's a nation, whether it's a family. And one of the things I think that what I call robust integration or that version of citizenship does is it transforms everyone. So I think what full citizenship will be for gays is actually all of those rights and all of that inclusion that we're talking about, but also it means the demand that heterosexual culture and heterosexual individuals also change, also transform their expectations and ideas about gender, about sexuality, about family, about love. It means an opening up of that. I guess one of the reasons that tolerance bothers me so much is that it asks very little of straight people. You can't have real change without asking not just for gays to have access to institutions in which they've been prohibited from entering, but you have to ask, how do all those things transform once different people enter into it. So how do we think about family forms? Transform when we separate out gender from family formations? It's a really profound question.
It truly is, and I appreciate as much thought and work as you put into it with your book.
Thank you.
I also very much appreciated, close to the summation, you write a paragraph, and I just want to quote from part of it in reference to the tolerance trap at work, and then I'd like you to respond.
Sure.
As gays are accepted, they're reminded that their very legitimacy, this is the tolerance trap, their acceptability is contingent on someone else deeming it so.
Yes, again, that's, you tolerate that which you do not really love. And that which you do not, you don't tolerate a beautiful day, you know. You don't tolerate a good book. You don't tolerate, you know, the pleasures of a good conversation. You tolerate that which you would rather avoid. Acceptance can always be turned and be unaccepted. You could be unaccepted. You could be rejected. I mean, the point about, you know, what I'm saying there is that tolerance always rests on the power remains with those doing that tolerating. I tolerate you. I accept you. I let you into my institution called marriage. I let you into my institution called the state, whatever it may be. And I think part of what we need to do is to resist that kind of mode. And tolerance can't resist it. I mean, tolerance always presumes someone's doing the tolerating. You know, oh, I tolerate this boring meeting I'm in. I'm doing the tolerating. I think, you know, that's a very different model than inclusion, integration, the challenge of real, robust, systematic, substantive social integration. Because that asks something of everybody.
And I am so glad you tolerated this interview as long as you have.
Oh, it's
Thank
been
you.
A pleasure. It's been a delight. Thank you.
I've enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My guest has been Dr. Susanna Walters. The Tolerance Trap, How God, Genes, and Good Intentions Are Sabotaging Gay Equality. We've barely been able to touch the surface of this work by Dr. Walters in this one-half-hour interview. Check out our website at thetolerancetrap.com. If you have any questions about these broadcasts, write to me at Rathbun Productions, R-A-T-H-B-U-N, Productions, at gmail.com. If you've missed the beginning of this program and would like to hear it in its entirety, there are a couple of ways. Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org, or National Public Radio's podcasts at their homepage, npr.org. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rothbund.